The most amazing thing, the creator of heaven and earth, the God who delivered them out of Egypt, declares that he's going to enter into a covenant with these people. It's not a contract. It's a kind of binding agreement between things which couldn't possibly have any relation to one another, save for this kind of device, something which binds together God and man in a promise forever.
Dr. Cass, in our last discussion, we talked about the giving of the law. What follows the giving of the law and what occupies the rest of the book of Exodus is something that if you're one of the Israelites, you might not have expected. It is this elaborate set of instructions to build God a tabernacle. And I suppose one question that we might begin with is why law should be deemed insufficient for this comprehensive legislation for people.
Okay, so we've had up to this point, we had the slavery and the deliverance, which becomes the national narrative. We have the giving of the law, which is a guide for public conduct and private morality. But we have this third piece of Exodus, and it becomes the third pillar of the foundation of the people, the construction of a tabernacle. And the question is that you've asked is, why can't we stop after the law and mores? I think many readers of the book of Exodus would be just as happy if it stopped there, because there are 13 chapters devoted to this, and it's on first, second, and third reading, tedious and boring, in which God becomes an architect, a furniture designer, an interior decorator, and one doesn't really know what's the point. Well, it turns out that there are things that the law, important though it is, does not touch and cannot address. There are certain human longings which the law doesn't reach. The longings to know and to be in touch with what is highest and best. There are certain human passions that the existing law doesn't speak to. Either the passions for beauty and order and artful making, or the wilder ecstatic passions for effacing boundaries, merging with the divine or with all else. There are also ignorances on the part of the people, which they would like to know who rules here and can we be in touch with it? In addition, the law might be important for regulating mutual wrongdoing or setting aside certain things in the calendar for festivals. But the question is whether the people as a whole need something more than that in order to become truly defined as a people, especially as a people that has been summoned to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. The law finished in a way in which our law doesn't, with teachings about the Sabbath reiterated and with teachings about the sacred festivals and with huge amount of attention exhorting them against idolatry and following the pagan ways in the land to which they're coming, namely in the land of Canaan. But there's been very little instruction to Israel to this point about how they should be in relation to the divine. Yes, they should keep the Sabbath, but what beyond that? That's once a week. Is there a need for further things to consolidate this community? Is there a need to address the question, how should they in fact be in relation to God? And the need to address these sometimes dangerous or at least ambiguous passions in the soul.
Mm. we should maybe take a step back.
Please.
In our previous conversation, you described to us a ritual that Moses undertakes. It doesn't seem instructed to do this by God, but of his own creativity and initiative, Moses undertakes a kind of sacrifice, erecting pillars, slaughtering bulls, sprinkling blood both on the pillars and on the people, all as a way to consecrate and to consecrate a covenant with God. The question, I suppose, is what did Moses understand about the people? And indeed, what does the book of Exodus understand about a deep-seated passion that we have for sacrifice? Maybe I could just ask you to expand on what sacrifice is and what role it plays in us.
Look, this is, the Bible is famously a book that seems to required to celebrate sacrifices. The book of Leviticus will fill in the full account of the sacrifices that have to be offered in the tabernacle by the priests. We get a taste of it in Exodus with the daily sacrifices are announced, the lamb offered in the morning and the evening. But if one reads Genesis and Exodus from the beginning, one sees that the text to begin with has at best an ambivalent view of human sacrifices. And maybe we go back over them a little bit. The first human sacrifice is offered uninstructed by Cain. Cain is the first man born of woman. Cain is the first person to build to bring a sacrifice. Cain is the first fratricide. Cain is the founder of the first city. Cain's descendants are the first inventors and users of the arts. So this is one package. This is proto-man. Adam might have been the first human being in Eden, but Cain is the first man born of woman, and he's characteristic. What's the meaning of Cain's sacrifices? Why do people sacrifice? They might sacrifice out of fear of the powers invisible, or to express gratitude to the powers invisible. They might sacrifice as a form of rational calculation, that if I somehow can please the powers invisible, they will be nice to me. And if you're a farmer, that means you're interested in who controls the rain. There is the possibility that this is not just rational calculation, but a kind of wildness in the soul, a wildness to overcome the boundaries and distinctions, like in rock concerts in which people let loose and look for some kind of ecstatic experience. In the beginning, God doesn't order these sacrifices. In the case of Noah, who gets off the ark, God has in a way chosen Noah to recreate a new terrestrial world after the evil that was washed out by the flood. Noah offers up some of his animal roommates uninstructed, and God says, "Never again will I curse the ground for man's sake, for the imagination of his heart is evil from his youth." And in place of this impulse, this would have been an expression of gratitude or possibly a bribe, a possible way of showing how we are superior to the animals. It's a way of saying, look, I'd like to please you, God, but there's a further complication with sacrifices. You want to please God. How are you going to do this? Well, what are you going to what do you think will please God? Well, the only thing you have to go on is, unless he tells you, is what would please you. Noah gets into his head that God might like roast meat.
Because that's what Noah likes.
That's what exactly what Noah likes. Mm-hmm. So the sequel to this is God basically says there's no point in starting over. We're not going to do better than this. We're going to let them eat their meat, but we're going to place a boundary. There will be no human sacrifice. There will be no, we'll take vengeance, punishment for murder.
Dr. Cass, that means that the way that you interpret that Noah story is not that God was necessarily pleased with Noah's sacrifice.
Correct.
but instead that God has understood, that God, we readers of the text, learn that God is learning, that human beings have this characteristic, this longing, that cannot be purged. It's just endemic to the human condition. And the need to offer something up is not going to be eradicable.
Right. And let me not be too negative on the about Noah. I mean, Noah, to his great credit, I mean, Noah has figured out on the ark that he's not just one among the animals. And one of the ways in which human beings differ from the animals is that they recognize that there are powers invisible and that there is a desire to be in touch with them. So the favorable part of this, Noah wants some kind of relationship with this God who sent the water and told him to build the ark. He doesn't quite know how to do it. It reveals itself in a certain bloody-mindedness that Noah has a taste for meat. The impulse to be in touch with the divine, the longing for the divine, but also a certain wildness, a certain willingness to shed blood as if the offering up of life is exactly what God would want. Those things are there in their beauty and in their problematic character, and you can't get rid of them exactly as you say. And the law given up to this point at Sinai doesn't address that at all.
Marilla, I still want to press you to see if I can understand more about why it is that man should have this need. The description, one description, that you, one set of reasons that you offer amounts to a way for man to grope around and find an answer to his insecurity.
Right.
The world seems dangerous. There is all kinds of misfortune, correct, tragedy, evil, and death in the world. And if I could somehow purchase divine protection,
right,
maybe that would satisfy me. That would seem to be a natural way of living in the world, a natural fear to have. And I'm not sure that one could, uninstructed, find a better answer to if one imagines that there is a God with the power for salvation, then acquiring that God's favor would be important. That's rational, it seems to me. But nevertheless, it is a kind of magic to try to transform God into your insurance agent.
Right. No, that's certainly right. And it, what looks like submission is in fact a certain kind of form of pride, that one thinks one is smart enough to know what divinity is, what divinity wants, what it takes to make divinity love me. That would be to put the kind of negative spin on this, perfectly understandable and in a way reasonable in the absence of knowledge or instruction. I think one wants also to put a certain positive construction on this too. There is a kind of divination of the human being of, you could say, of his own godlike status. It comes with a temptation of prideful sense, as one saw in the city of Babel, that man can be a god to man, and that we don't trust these promises after the flood. We're going to build a high rise here and with its top in heaven. And we'll either control divinity because we will be able to reach up to them directly, or we will simply be the divine source of our own protection. But there is a certain divination on the part of human beings that we're good, but we are mortal and we're insufficient and we're incomplete. And there might be a desire to be in touch with what is better than we are, what is eternal, what is perfect. And that, so it's not just the kind of longing, it's not simply a desire for insurance against the fearful things, but there's a certain longing, I think, for completion, for for being in contact with what is highest and what is best. These impulses are all mixed in there together.
Right. It would seem that why would one not, now just ask the question, why would it naturally occur to man to offer up slaughtered animals as the sacrifice? Now, one possibility is that in a world where roasted meat is precious and pleasing, then one can superimpose one's own desires onto God's desires and offer up to him what is pleasant to oneself. That's the story of Noah. It strikes me that there's also something maybe more elemental. Any parent who's been present at the initial breaths of a baby understands that they are standing before something awesome and mysterious, that life is somehow animating this creature for the first time. And the very fact of having the power to remove life and offer it up would seem to be something of great preciousness, great value. It seems to me that there's something awesome that a man is trying to recreate in offering up an animal that was alive and is now dead for the sake of this God.
No, I think that's quite lovely. And especially if you add to that the possibility that this is somehow a substitute for one's own life, that one recognizes the preciousness of life and one's own life, and that this is a kind of gift of gratitude, and you could also say even atonement for the ways in which we are misusing the gift of this life. That this is acknowledgement of a source and of the awesomeness of the gift of life.
These more considered factors, combined with, as you were saying before, the also natural impulse for some kind of ecstatic union with something beyond our daily experience, these seem to be at the root of the human motivation to sacrifice. And that human motivation, as we've seen in the book of Genesis and previously in the book of Exodus, emerges from mankind's experience in an uninstructed way. And now God would seem to be saying that there's a need to impose some structure on that human impulse. And that is how you begin to understand the construction of the tabernacle.
That's the beginning of it. And let's just reiterate the thing that we talked about at the end of last time. The chapter before, chapter 24, has the sacrifice of in the ratification of the covenant that involves the pillars and much strewing of blood thrown onto the people. But it also has the aestheticized encounter with God in the vision of the elders of the elite halfway up the mountain. Both of those things I read in that chapter to be problematic because uninstructed, and both of them are now going to be dealt with. You're going to have a very beautiful building, but artfully produced by specific artisans, but who are going to be following precise orders given by the architect who's not Frank Lloyd Wright. And you're going to have the opportunity to have sacrifices, but again, ministered by certain officials who understand the awesomeness of their responsibility. And this will be done under very careful regulation and cabined, housed, but also educated and elevated these particular passions of the soul.
Okay, that would seem to be a existential or psychological reason for the tabernacle to be built. Is there also, in your reading, a political function that the construction of the tabernacle plays?
Yes. The question is whether the... And let me also back off again and say one further thing, which we missed in the discussion of the law. Israel starts in watery Egypt. It goes to the dry wilderness, where water is at a premium. Israel doesn't have its land. It doesn't have an economy. It doesn't have an army. It has only this law given in the desert. Israel becomes a people. It's the only people in history that became a people with a moral, political, and spiritual mission before it had the conditions of political life. And one of the things you're seeing in the tabernacle is the suggestion that, okay, the law and its spiritual direction and the original covenant to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, that's the telos, that's the purpose. But can the people actually be formed to that purpose only by the given law that largely regulates interpersonal conduct with a few addenda about Sabbath keeping, festivals, and the like? And the suggestion is, no, maybe for Moses, who can converse with God on an intellectual plane, law, argument, morality, that will be fine. The people seem to need visible signs, gestures, rituals, practices. So that this is, I won't say a concession, but that this is an instrument for helping to forge a people. How? In this case, look, if you sort of follow the trajectory, the first great building project in the Bible is the creation. God gave the orders, God carried it out. Beginning of Exodus, God is somehow still in charge, or Pharaoh gives the orders, for example, and the children of Israel carry out the orders. God gives the orders, but the children of Israel are active in carrying it out. And when they come to actually bring the offerings and do this, they do so with enthusiasm. So this is a communal action on their part. Before we heard them sing a communal song, now they're engaged in a communal building project.
Indeed, when God first commands Moses to say, to announce these building plans to the people, he requests that Moses, in turn, request of the people that they provide for the building materials from their own stuff.
Right. A willing contribution, as much as you would like, of precious things. And it turns out they provide them to such excess that the artisans say, oh, we've got enough. So it's an action done in obedience. And it somehow serves the, it will be a kind of, it's not so much going to be a building as it's going to be sort of the crossroads for the communication between the people and their gods. So when they gather, they will be gathering for their more than political purpose. One more thing. The tabernacle is, some people want to call it God's palace, and it's plausible, but it's portable. Wherever they go, they have to erect it. When they move on, they take it down. It's a regular building project to provide a place where there could be communication with God. If they build it, he says he will come. So it becomes a continuing communal project of building according to his instructions for the sake of being in permanent everyday contact with God.
So it seemed to be that having previously together sung to the Lord, now as a further step in the constitution of this people, they're charged to do something together. And the doing something in and of itself would have a homogenizing or civic building up quality within the people.
Absolutely. I mean, this is... these deeds can form a community more than words can.
When naive readers encounter the book of Exodus, they have a very natural question when it comes to all the sacrifice business, which is that the creator of the heaven and the earth, what does he need this for? Is there any suggestion about God deriving some benefit such that God would need or even want these sacrifices?
Well, I mean, for the most part, I've used to read this as The sacrifices were just concessions to the human impulse and need to sacrifice. And if they're going to do it, we should at least keep it under wraps and not let it go wild. But the more I thought about it, the more it seems to me that God needs, not in the sense in which we need food. He doesn't need this to stay alive, but he does in a certain way need this to live in the people. That is, in the absence of the ritual recognition of his presence in these forms of offering expressions of gratitude or of contrition, in the absence of that, he fades from presence in their lives. And to fade from presence is, in a certain way, not to be fully and fully in the world. So the whole desire of God to have a place to abide in their midst, where they can regularly in their everyday life be in communication with him through their offerings, is a way in which he will be and be known. And in the absence of the sacrifices, in the absence of the traffic, it's a form of indifference, and in a certain way, his existence is, for all human purposes, negated. He is not known, and to that extent is less.
So that the indwelling of God in the people of Israel,
yep,
is mediated by the people of Israel's constant effort to somehow commune,
right,
with that God, and these sacrifices is that effort.
Exactly. That this is sacrifices up, speech and blessings down. And when they gather in the place, they gather in the expectation that they might somehow feel the presence. What that is, we'll have to talk about later.
Before we move on too quickly past the furnishing,
right,
of raw materials out of the Israelites' possessions into something which is now truly communal,
yep,
I want to trace backwards where these slaves have so many precious things in the first place. As I recall, God says more than once, several times, before the Israelites depart from Egypt, that they will despoil Egypt. Can you help us understand what's happening with that?
Well, I mean, several times that's said, and when they leave, the Egyptians give them all kinds of gold and silver and fine clothing to take with them. Many people read this as, of course, payment for the suffering and indignity that they experienced and from which the Egyptians profited. But I read this as the Israelites leaving Egypt are given gold and silver. These are raw materials. Raw materials can be used and be made available for building the tabernacle, but as we will talk about next time, they are also available for building something else, which building something else turns out to arise right in the middle of this story of the tabernacle. So the children of Israel are given this stuff, and we're going to find out what are they going to use it for. Here they're being asked to make a sacrifice of something precious, to do it willingly for the sake of building this place where the Lord will abide in their midst. I'm inclined to think that this is in a way a test. They have this material. We're going to find out how it matters to them and what purpose it will be used for.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's useful to adopt your methodology in reading the text. To us, it's so obvious that they would have chosen to use this material for this purpose. But putting oneself in the drama of the way that the story of Exodus is told, Is it so obvious that a people covetous of wrought these precious materials, having never in their lives had access to them before, would have chosen not to give them away to some kind of common purpose? Maybe they would have, it would have been perfectly understandable for them to want to keep. That's in a way natural. And the fact that they are so willing to give also tells us something, perhaps that the communal resources that one wants to strengthen and enhance in the building of the project are there in seed to begin with.
I'm not sure, because they might be there in seed, but the generous giving of these things we learn about only after the story of the golden calf. And we're not going to talk about that now, but it's important to understand in the narrative of the text, Moses is up on the mountain. We're told that he's up there for 40 days and 40 nights. The people were never told how long he was going to be up there. While he's getting these instructions, if we had a split screen and we could watch what was going on down below, the people, fearful that Moses has entered this fiery cloud, is not coming back. It's at that particular point that their gold and silver is enlisted by Aaron in satisfying their wish to make us a God who will go in Moses' place before them. So this is another view of what's in the soul of people and why, fearful that their one access to the divine has been taken from them, they now have these resources to do something in its place.
Once this portable edifice is constructed, there are going to be things which occur there. Previously, Jethro had divided the labor in the Israelite camp. Now God divides the labor in the Israelite camp and specifies Aaron and his people to have this special role. In your analysis of God's disclosure of the fact, you make much of the fact that God refers to Aaron as Moses' brother several times. Tell us why and what you make of Aaron's being in charge of sacrifices.
We have the institution of a new domain of the theological, political life of this people. It's not just Moses. It's not just Moses with Joshua fighting off an invading horde of Amalekites. It's not just Moses being the mouthpiece of transmitting God's law to the people, but there is a whole cultic sacrificial domain, the domain of worship, which is not going to be Moses' business. That's going to belong not to the political leadership, but to the priestly class. And it's Moses' brother Aaron who is designated for this. We already had a hint of this earlier when Jethro comes and to offer sacrifices, and he offers it with Aaron and the elders, and Moses isn't mentioned in that sacrifice. Sacrificing doesn't seem to be Moses' strong suit or proclivity. He doesn't need it. It's really much more in the people's domain. God very pointedly tells Moses that he shall appoint his brother Aaron as high priest and his sons. He shall make his clothing. He shall install him. And this emphasis on the fact that Aaron is his brother is striking. Brotherhood from the book of Genesis is not the brotherhood that we've all been taught about. Brotherhood in the book of Genesis is rivalry, always at risk of fratricide, partly because no one has taught them the importance of brotherhood. The natural relations of two brothers is rivalry, and often deadly. Cain and Abel, paradigmatic story. Every one of the next generations, a danger of fratricide. Ishmael and Isaac, Esau and Jacob, Joseph and his brothers narrowly escaped. Aaron enters this whole picture in Exodus because Moses, in a way, complains, send somebody else. And God is angry with him. And then he says, is there not Aaron, your brother? He will go with you. He will be your mouthpiece. And that sort of calms Moses down. But a careful reader who's been following the problem of brothers wonders whether the insertion of a brother here is now going to introduce the problem of fratricide again. And why is that a problem? Because the ruler as ruler, the leader as leader, has no equal. That's, in a way, the meaning of making the founder always a fratricide. In with Cain and Romulus and Remus, the brotherhood relation is one of equality. The leader lords it over the brother by office or by wish. And there means you can eradicate the brotherly relation. You kill your brother as a brother, even if you never lay a hand on him. So there's a question for a suspicious reader. It turns out the suspicion for the longest time looks idle because they meet, Aaron kisses Moses, they get along very, very well. There's no apparent rivalry. But if you're watching, Aaron's role is diminishing with the plagues. God says several times that he's doing this so that the people will trust in Moses forever. And Aaron, where's Aaron? Now it turns out Aaron's going to be in charge of the Holy of Holies. Aaron is going to be mediating the daily sacrifices. Aaron and his sons in perpetuity are going to be responsible for the priestly governance of the community. And it looks as if they're preparing for not just with the giving of the law, but with the institution of the tabernacle, preparing for Moses' departure. Moses' leadership will pass not only into the law, but the role of Moses in the daily life of the people will be much more in the hands of the priests, which is a domain for which Moses is not suited. And let me just complete. It turns out that the fratricidal possibility still hovers over this story going forward. Aaron, while Moses is getting these very instructions, is down there building a golden calf. And Aaron will later, with Miriam, rebel against Moses. And finally, Aaron will die for Moses' sin in striking rather than speaking to the rock. Aaron did nothing, but God says, because you, Moses, did this, both of you. So, and further, the sons of Aaron, the iniquities of the fathers are visited upon the sons. Nadav and Abihu, who accompanied Aaron in that escapade on the mountain with that hallucination, they die for excessive exuberance in offering sacrifices that early in Leviticus. So this problematic business with the brothers is here. I think part of the reason God was angry was hoping to avoid this problem in the beginning. Couldn't do it.
Dr. Cass, in having discussed both the natural human impulse to sacrifice and the way that the construction of a pageant of ordered beauty in the edifice of the tabernacle, cabins and channels, that natural human passion, but also elevates it to something in touch with the Redeemer of this nation and the Creator of the universe. And moreover, in having discussed the political significance of this communal building project, we've talked about two crucial elements of the tabernacle. You suggest in your analysis a crucially important third dimension, a theological dimension. With your permission, I'd like to hold that part of the discussion until a future conversation in which we discuss God as the subject of that whole conversation. Moreover, you've alluded several times to the episode of the golden calf. We're going to discuss that next time. What are some of the questions that we should have in mind as we enter into that discussion?
The question for the Golden Calf episode is, what do we learn about the people in that episode that can also illuminate the meaning of the tabernacle, which is being built in part because of what that episode shows us? I think we learn something about the difference between Moses and Aaron as leaders of the people. We learn something about the passions that lurk in the human soul. We learn something about Moses's failure to understand the needs of the people. And we will learn something extraordinary about how, after that, in a conversation between Moses and God, Moses gets educated as to what it will take for him really to lead these people, not as an outsider, but as one of them. And he becomes, in a way, God's agent, not just of violence, but as teacher inside the community on a daily basis. There is one thing, I think, John, about pointing towards what we should also look about when we get to the discussion about God. And it belongs here in this way. It's very easy to overlook, in the midst of all of the instructions about the furniture and the costumes of the priests, that God says several times what the purpose of this tabernacle is. He doesn't say it's to address the unruly passions of the human soul. He says he wants to build this place so that I might abide with them, first time. And then towards the end of Exodus 29, the very end of Exodus 29, he says of the whole project that the Israelites shall know that I am the Lord their God who took them out of the land of Egypt in order that I might abide with them. The tabernacle is not just for the children of Israel. The tabernacle is also for God. And we could probably talk about that subsequently.
So when we come to this discussion about God, we'll have to try to understand what abiding in the midst of the children of Israel means. But we'll have to come back and explain it to us then.
Okay.
Dr. Cass, thank you.
Thanks, John.